mean, if you're sending a SWAT team, who really cares what house they go into? Hello and welcome to Terrifying Robot Dog. I'm Jonathan Stark.
And I'm Kelly Shaver.
And we're here to talk about how technology is changing the way we interact with the world. This week, we talk about not trusting everything you read online. Please stay tuned. Terrifying Robot Dog is next. Do I sound super fast?
No, not super fast.
Oh, bummer.
Well, do you want to sound super fast? Oh, your internet.
Yeah.
You're definitely... You have more bits now.
Yep.
I can tell you have more bits.
I'm much more bitty.
Yeah.
Still kind of echoey, but I have to just deal with that for now.
Yeah, get you some foam.
Exactly. It's on the agenda.
Oh, yeah.
But got the internet today, dear listener. 75 up and down. Must be nice.
Yes. Did we mention last week that you moved into a new office?
I don't know. I think so. I was complaining about my echo, I think so.
Oh, yeah. I think it might have been.
Yeah, we need to do something about
the
echo.
I couldn't remember if that was before we started recording or after.
Oh, you're right. It probably was before. But yeah, I'm in a new office, and it sounds like this! My neighbors are probably like, what the hell's going on in there?
What is wrong with them? Yeah. Yeah. Have you put an echo in your office yet?
Oh, yeah. Kidding me? I had an echo before it was connected to the internet.
You had an echo before you had an echo.
Yes, I have double echo.
Nice.
I say Alexa once and she turns on twice.
Kinky.
Anywho. So, okay. So this is going to be a fun show for me because Kelly has a fun article to report and I have not read it yet. So I'm super intrigued about what the... Now, what's the title?
The title is How an Internet Mapping Glitch Turned a Random Kansas Farm into a Digital Hell.
See, now I thought most Kansas farms were already a digital hell, but I guess it's not the case.
I think you're thinking of like New Jersey townhouses.
Oh, you're right. So, okay. So I saw this popping up into my feeds, but I didn't yet read it. So I'm looking forward to finding out how this is going to affect the way this technology is affecting the way we're interacting with the world.
Yeah. Yeah. It's certainly affecting the physical world for some people. And not just this one family. There are several mentions in the article, but it mainly focuses on one family. And in order to understand it first, we have to talk about GeoIP services and GeoIP location and that sort of thing.
Okay. So what's GeoIP?
GeoIP is basically like you visit a website, the website logs your IP address, and then contacts either their own servers or a third-party server or company or what have you and says, okay, where does this IP address, where does it come from in the world? Like physically, what's the physical location?
Hmm. Okay. So I'm aware of that. I've been aware of it also. There's certain like ISPs that buy a block and then they're, you know, like a big ISP and sort of like, it seems like everybody is from the same place when really they're all over the place, almost like a VPN type of situation.
Yeah. That's the thing with GeoIP location is it's sometimes mildly to severely inaccurate. Because like you said, maybe an ISP is about a block and it all, technically this block belongs to this ISP at this address, but it's used by people in three states.
Right. Is that what I kind of thought the article might have something to do with that, but maybe, like what's the...
It's similar to that. And because at best, you can track an IP address down to a home address. At worst, you get it at like the country level.
Yeah, same difference.
Yeah, same difference, you know. Yeah. So what if you're off by a few tens of thousands of miles?
I mean, if you're sending a SWAT team, who really cares what house they go into?
Exactly. So the story is this company, GeoIP location service called MaxMind, when they can't, let's say they can't get any more accurate than a country or a state, they will set the latitude and longitude associated with that IP address to the middle of the country or the middle of the state. And because the longitude and latitude for the exact middle of the U.S. is a really annoying decimal number, they round it a bit.
Yeah.
And now it goes right to like the driveway of this farm in Wichita, Kansas.
Oh, my God. Okay.
So since about 2011, these people have been getting harassing phone calls, threats, because, you know, hackers hack IP or hijack IP addresses and things like that and disguise themselves. It's going to end up looking like a lot of people are from the middle of the country that aren't. And a lot of those people are going to be up to nefarious and or illegal or dangerous things.
Okay. So let me translate that back.
Okay.
So somebody who's masking their IP address,
or even their IP address, just can't be tracked down accurately.
That's okay. So someone who is doing something nefarious is probably smart enough to use an IP that can't be tracked down accurately. And if MaxMind figures that it's in the US somewhere, they're basically saying it's this people's house.
Yeah, exactly.
So anybody who used MaxMind to figure out why their website or whatever is getting hacked thinks it's these particular people.
Exactly. Yeah, it's the family on this farm in Kansas.
And now, how has that played out for the family? Like you said, they've been harassed, but what does that actually mean?
They've been harassed. They've gotten death threats. They've gotten visits from law enforcement agencies. The sheriff's department in Wichita, Kansas, has had to step in and intervene on their behalf with other law enforcement agencies on multiple occasions.
This is shocking because...
Yeah, it's crazy.
So here's the tie-in with the show. The tie-in with the show is that everybody who is harassing these people or like going after them is placing a whole lot of trust in the accuracy of MaxMind for no reason.
Yeah.
They're just like, do a search, reverse geo IP look. Here's the IP to reverse lookup. And then they get an answer and they assume
that it's accurate.
That it's accurate to the point where they're willing to make death threats, which is a federal offense.
Yeah. And like put broken toilets on their driveway. And it's crazy.
The thing that's super scary about that to me is how much, the trust you're placing in a Google search.
Yeah.
Oh, I obviously just found the people who are hacking my... These are obviously the people.
Right. These are obviously the people.
Must be them.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I mean, the article goes on to mention, like, there's the guy that's coincidentally in the exact center of Virginia has had the same problem. The guy who's coincidentally in the center of Atlanta.
Ugh. Those people should start hacking people.
Right.
Because they could just be like, it wasn't me.
It wasn't me. Yeah. But what gets me is, like you said, the amount of trust that people are putting into this IP lookup service. I mean, even other law enforcement agencies.
Yeah. Like before you even told me the story, like one of the things I said was that they're historically very bad. They're just very untrustworthy. But
yeah.
But no one knows that. Like people with guns don't know that.
Right. I mean, I was having this exact same conversation yesterday morning with a coworker about the inaccuracy of GeoIP tracking, because we use it in our app for some things.
Yeah.
And as do lots of statistics gathering type applications and services that serve local ads and all that. And what do you do about it? You know?
Yeah. So this gets into a topic that I think is going to be just keep getting bigger and bigger over, I mean, decades, like as the younger generation starts to grow up and like the information that's about someone, in this case, it's an address, the information about someone can either be wrong or something that they want to just go away, you know, something that's really embarrassing or whatever. It's just not that doable, right? It's like, it's very difficult to do that. In fact, some people can make it impossible for you to do that, you know, aka WikiLeaks.
You can do a search. You can do a search for this family's address on Google now, and it still comes up to pages about all of the illegal activities that they've been involved in and that sort of thing. I haven't done it because I don't know the specific address. Of course, there is the latitude and longitude here. I could go look, but it's just... Well, and there too, with so many mobile devices floating around and in use now and things on the go and people on the go, even if that information, even if the GeoIP information is accurate, you still can't trust it.
Yeah, right. It's certainly not enough to take like felonious action.
Mm-hmm.
Oh man, that's wild. I mean, the trust that people will put in a Google search and some nameless GeoIP lookup that they never even heard of, and just be like, oh yeah, this is
that's got to be it. Yeah.
Yeah. This obviously, I caught you. The really scary thing is that other law enforcement doesn't get it.
Yeah.
That's kind of horrifying.
You know, I think the saddest part of this whole thing is that, you know, there are notes up at the sheriff's department about this family that say these people are not suicidal, which means someone has been, you know, like somewhere out there are these suicidal people that are on the internet crying for help and people are tracking their IP addresses down to this random family other than the person who needs it.
So like recent news, we tend not to talk about recent news on the podcast, but I suppose this topic's not going to go away really ever. which is encryption and security. And we've been talking about that in the FBI iPhone issue. And the, and recently we haven't talked about this, but, in the last couple of days, WhatsApp, which has a billion users, WhatsApp's a chat application. It's not super popular in the US, so people might not have heard of it, but they have a billion users. Facebook bought them maybe a year or two ago.
A billion. That's insane.
Yeah. Yeah. Like Facebook's got like 1.5 billion. WhatsApp has a billion. WhatsApp's the second biggest social network, if you want to call it that. It's basically a chat application. And it was originally, it was a replacement for SMS in countries where, you know, outside of the US where SMS was prohibitively expensive. So it was kind of a drop in replacement for that, and it got super popular. And they recently just decided to turn on end-to-end encryption so that even they can't see what messages are being transmitted over the network, which means that if a law enforcement agency got a court order for them to release, you know, like messaging between two parties, they would not be able to comply with it.
Right. They couldn't do it.
Right. So this whole, you know, and law enforcement agencies, which are incentivized on arresting people, they're not incentivized on things not happening.
Right.
They're incentivized on them catching criminals.
Right.
It
should really be the other way around.
Yeah. It would be nice if you changed the incentive of how law enforcement officials were rewarded, then there would be less of a tendency for them to want to break down every door, you know,
less arrest first, ask questions later.
Exactly. So in the digital realm, the idea of getting a court order to enter somebody's apartment or home or open a safe deposit box, it's a totally different thing in the digital realm, because if you get that court order, it's for everyone. You know, it's not just for one safety deposit box. It's for all safety deposit boxes. And the vulnerability becomes available really to anybody on the planet.
Yeah. And you may tell yourself that's not going to happen, and you may do your best to prevent it from happening, but it's pretty naive to think that you can ever actually keep that. Once the door's been opened, it's pretty naive to think that you can ever actually keep that closed again.
Yeah, it's impossible. If it was possible, then Edward Snowden wouldn't exist. Like the whole Snowden thing wouldn't exist. WikiLeaks wouldn't exist.
Yeah.
Because no one would leak any information, because we've got these secrets.
The Panama Papers would not exist.
Right. You know, the way to keep a secret is not tell anyone.
Right.
And if you're telling anybody, and then it's not secret, right? And it's like, even law enforcement officials, like heads of the CIA, like former heads of the CIA's intelligence agencies, they're for encryption. Mm-hmm. Don't put backdoors in encryption, because we need it too. Like we want secrets, and eventually,
right, they need it.
Yeah, ISIS or the Chinese government, or, you know, whether you're talking about industrial espionage or terrorism or whatever. It's like both directions. It's like you don't want anybody else to keep secrets, but you want you to be able to keep secrets, but it doesn't work like that. And
it doesn't work that way.
Yeah. People who have been around long enough, they understand that a backdoor is a bad idea, because it's going to apply to everyone. Mm-hmm. And they'd rather have their secrets than know everybody else's secrets.
Which I think is the smart decision.
I agree. But it raises the issue of like, well, to get back to the idea of being able, what can this family do about this? So like this information is online. So I got into the encryption thing because it's like, well, you could actually keep this information offline, but this is a different issue. Like once information is online, you know, it would almost be easier for them to move than to do anything about it. Like who do you call?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess
you're going to call up Google
or what's the name of the company?
MaxMind. Yeah. Supposedly they're working on it now that they're aware of the problem.
Yeah, now that it's getting all sorts of press.
Yeah, and which may be true for the family in Wichita, Kansas, but what about everyone else who happens to be in the exact middle of a city or state?
This reminds me of my personal telephone number is one digit away from PayPal customer support.
Right, yeah.
So I would get all these, like, what am I going to do? I get all these phone calls. It hasn't happened in a while. They might have changed it. It hasn't happened in a long time. But for a while there, I was getting calls every day of people who are having problems with their PayPal account.
And they were giving you information about their PayPal account.
Yeah, they'd leave stuff on my answering machine. I could have easily, easily called people back and been like, okay, I'm looking at your account now. Just give me your username and password and I'll
yeah, I had an uncle whose number was one off from the local pizza place. So, and he got so many calls that he would just like take their order. So people were reading off their credit card information to him over the phone because he wasn't doing anything with it. He wasn't even writing it down. But, you know, if someone had wanted to do that.
Yeah. Like at first I would call people back and be like, you didn't actually call, you know, like right. Somebody's got a problem. They think they left a message for PayPal and PayPal never gets back to them. And so I felt bad for PayPal and like, you know, and then, and I would try and the person, because the person, yeah. they always sounded upset, like horribly yeah. desperate. It's like their yeah. money. I can't get my money and I need to. And so I'd call them back and be yeah. like, you called the wrong number. And they immediately start yelling at me, being like, no, I did. What do you do? I need this fixed immediately. And I'm like, you got the wrong, I'm trying to tell you, you dialed the wrong number.
Like, I'm trying to help you.
Yeah. And so I stopped yeah. doing it. And you right. can imagine this situation where, like, once the person believes the information on, say, a Wikipedia, I mean, think of how much trust Wikipedia has. Mm-hmm. Never mind MaxMind. But you think of a Wikipedia, and that's just being edited by, like, clowns.
Yeah. It has. There are a lot of checks in place, and it has gotten a lot more reliable and accurate through the years. But still, things slip through or things get changed and it's up for a while before someone notices or that kind of thing. So, yeah, it can still happen.
And so, like, you know, the 10,000 high school students who are writing a report
yeah,
all think that Donald Trump actually has a raccoon living on his head.
Yeah, like Kira was working on a report the other day and she was asking for some help about where to find things. And she said, we're not allowed to use Wikipedia as a source. And where do I find things? And I was just like,
yeah, I don't know. I don't know what to tell you.
Well, you go to the Wikipedia article and you click the reference links at the bottom.
Right. I mean, I remember the Encyclopedia Britannica. I used to read that thing like it was a Star Trek novel. I'd be like on that
yeah.
thing.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Same here. I would look it up in my Funkin' Wagnall.
It's so no okay. So here's this is probably the topic is slowly emerging, which is that those things they were wrong. Like mm-hmm. there were mistakes in them, even if it was just stuff that changed since they were printed. But there was a certain
they had a lifespan.
Yeah, there's a veracity to it. There were like checks and balances. It felt like, and it was like I mean. I guess it's kind of the same thing, but this, because, you know, there's still sort of, you know, there are newspapers that are accused of yellow journalism, and that's definitely true. I can tell you from being in a newspaper family mm-hmm. and where the opinions of the publishers get translated into articles that are not opinion articles or shouldn't be opinion articles.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, everybody's seen that. And, but even like you think about a dictionary, what words get picked to go into the dictionary or not, or maybe more importantly, an encyclopedia, that stuff, it was like a 10-year cycle that would be wrong or inaccurate. And I almost feel like there's like, I guess this is just, you know, get off my lawn thinking, but there was something a little bit more trustworthy about that than like Wikipedia, where it's just changing so fast, potentially changing, you know, every second.
Yeah. And I mean, it's not like that doesn't on some level exist on the internet, because a lot of things on the internet are dated. And like, I know, like if I'm looking up an answer to how do I do something in this code, if the blog post on it is more than like 6 months old, I just ignore it and go on, you know? So, I mean,
yeah. Like the question is how much should you trust stuff that's online?
Right. It's easy to find old information or inaccurate information online. And you would have no idea of how old it is, or maybe it's old, but it's still the only thing you can find.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, super interesting. And it depends on the type of information I'm searching for. So like code stuff changes so fast that you're like, you know, it's just useless if it's older mm-hmm. than whatever. But then there's other stuff that, you know, I'll like look up, I don't know, like, some sort of business topic, and that stuff's pretty evergreen. It's,
yeah.
It's basically true because it's based on human psychology, which changes very slowly.
Yeah. Or if I'm looking up something about a thing that happened in 1999, do I really care if the article was written in 2001 versus 2006?
Right. Right. Like the Nixon presidency. Like, right. Do you really need brand new information on that?
Right.
So we've talked before. I don't know if we've talked on this show about it before, but that there's this, I mean, there's a possibility, or I certainly wouldn't say a probability, but there is a theoretical possibility that with the advent of smartphones reaching, you know, 4 billion people, say 90% of the adults in mm-hmm. the US by 2020, 80% of adults globally by 2020, that the idea of literacy is a blip on the historical record. So like I know we've talked about this before, you and I, but maybe not on the show, but
I think we talked about it on a niche.
Yeah, like the written word is an encoding for things that happen inside the human brain. So it's a way to encode it so that you can take it out of the brain, transport it to somebody else's brain where they decode it by reading it. And it's just an encoding. It's like base 64.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not that great. Like it has a lot of downsides. It's pretty popular. I'll grant you.
Yeah, it's pretty popular.
Very popular, and I'll grant you that. But as you know, as I'm raising like a 2-year-old and a 6-year-old, the you know, learning a spoken language is orders of magnitude easier and more natural than learning how to read, becoming literate. And if you're going to put all that work into something, it needs to have a really high return on investment, which for years and years and years and years, hundreds of years, has been true because it was the way that people stored thoughts outside of their head.
Mm-hmm.
There was really no other way. But now that everybody's got a video and audio recorder in their pocket that has real time connectivity to persistent cloud storage and other people directly, you're like, I can envision a world easily where Maggie is able to become incredibly well educated without ever having to learn how to read, because she could just, you know, I mean, half the stuff I learn these days is from YouTube. I don't need to read for that.
Right. Yeah. That's right. I'm reading through a book right now, learning a new programming language and reading through a book, and I'm spending about an hour a day on it, because any more than that of reading this dense material and my brain just turns to mush.
Hmm.
And but sometimes when I'm burned out on that, I think I can just go and watch a video.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a different part of your brain. It's much more passive. But so here's how it relates. So I thought about this for a long time. It's like, what's the difference? You know, what are the pros and cons of switching off of a text encoding to like an audio or video encoding? And one of the things you lose in a text encoding, one of the many things you lose in a text encoding is identity. It's really, really easy to impersonate somebody else in text. It's really, really hard to impersonate somebody on audio, and it's even harder on video. So if the source of the article or the source of the information is important, there's a big difference between seeing a 3 paragraphs of text with President Barack Obama written underneath it
versus seeing him give that speech.
Yeah, because it would be so hard to falsify the video right. plus audio.
Yeah. Okay. Now I see how you're bringing it back around to the credibility thing.
Yeah. It's this trust thing. So like if you, like imagine, like you text with Kira a lot in the house. I exclusively text with Erica. We literally never have phone calls.
Yeah. Like I was texting with Kira just a few minutes ago. She was walking home from school.
Right. And so now I do this all the time. I do it with, that's how I keep in touch with friends. We're all connected on Facebook, and we text. We almost never talk. And one time, suddenly appeared to me once when one of my friend's Facebook accounts got hacked, and the person who hacked it started texting me. And it took me a while to realize it wasn't the guy.
Yeah.
Now, if he had called me, I would have instantaneously been like, who the hell is this?
Right.
You know, like, you're not Brian.
Right. And I mean, sure, he could have said things in the text that immediately clued you in. But it's also very easy to text message things that aren't going to, like, let you know right away that this person is not the person you think it is.
Yeah. It turned out this person wasn't even an English speaker. Looked like he was just going back through our previous chat logs and trying to pick out, you know,
stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. And so when I started to catch on to it, I was like, you know, of course he was asking me to send him money because he was stuck somewhere. And, you know, the hacker. Yeah. And I was like, tell you what, if you send me a photo, you shave off your beard and send me a picture of it, and I'll send you $1,000. And he stopped chatting me. But it's like, but what did I ask for? I asked for a photo.
A photo,
I asked for a photo that I know only he could take.
Mm-hmm.
And it would have been funny if he like took his profile photo and like photoshopped
out the beard.
Terrible foot there.
Terrible Photoshop job. Yeah. It's like, there's, see that growth. This is why I have the beard.
Right. But so with the, there's something about, I mean, really, I guess it's a temporary situation. Like the temporary situation being that right now, current technology, it's brutally difficult to impersonate somebody's voice patterns, or and especially a video, like their mannerisms of video of someone. Like you could, even the best, you know, Rich Little mm-hmm. slash impressionist isn't going to fake you out and like, oh, that's actually Barack Obama. No.
Yeah.
So you do, it's interesting because right now, if you look at the bulk of the information, I don't know if this is true. And I suppose it depends on how you measure it, but I was going to say the bulk of information on the internet is textual.
I don't know. Well, like it depends on how you measure it.
Yeah. Size, file size is
even so, I'm not sure it's true anymore.
Right.
It probably still is, but it feels like there's
so many cat pictures.
There's a lot of media out mm-hmm. there that's not.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, especially if you're counting still images too.
Yeah. So if we, it is funny to think about, like, well, if information was encoded in ways that were more, that had identity baked in a way that text never had and doesn't, probably never will, then I wonder if it would mitigate some of these just like complete misplaced trust situations of completely misplaced trust.
Well, I mean,
probably not this particular one.
Probably not this particular one, but I think you're talking about, and I don't know if anyone still does it anymore, but, your PGP signatures for your emails.
That's exactly what I was thinking too.
Yeah.
And that gets back to the end-to-end encryption on, see, I don't think, so the public private key thing has two parts. One is the encryption of the message, but the other one is identity. So if you never associated an identity with a private key, it doesn't automatically have that identity baked into it.
Right. Like I could say, this is my key pair, but if you've never, like still, if I've never done anything to verify, like, oh, this belongs to me. Mm-hmm. What's to stop you from generating a new key pair and saying, oh yeah, this is Kelly's key pair.
Right. And so the way they do that on the blockchain with Bitcoin is that it doesn't matter because your whole reputation is tied to the private key anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't really matter who you are. It just matters whether or not the person who owns that private key is trustworthy, and that can't be altered.
Yeah, which kind of makes more sense.
If you think of your identity being tied to a private key that you are issued when you're born, and everything that you do online is associated with that private key, then it doesn't really, that's your name. Like that's your identity. That's your face.
Making notes for a novel here.
Right. And so now here's the weird thing, like on Tor
then there's going to be a black market. There's going to be a black market for people's private keys.
Already exists. You can, that's exactly what I was just going to say, which is that you on, what the heck was the name of it? Silk Road.
Yeah.
You could pay someone to buy their user account. Like you could buy their thing, which was really valuable if they had a good reputation. So if you built up a really good reputation, it's kind of like the Dread Pirate Roberts, right? From, you know, there's always a new Dread Pirate Roberts. It's a different guy every time.
Yeah, it's a different guy.
But, you know, it's the Dread Pirate, the Dread Private Roberts, Private Key Roberts. I tried, it was a stretch.
You tried. It was a good try.
Thank you. But the idea is that you could then pull, you know, remove your face and put it on someone else and be like, all right, now you're the trustworthy one. And now I'm anonymous again. So, man, I don't know
that solves anything.
No, I don't know. I feel like
we've been creating more questions than answers these past few episodes.
Yeah, this is kind of inevitable. I mean, it's starting to happen already where it's like as the internet and the applications built on top of it, like the web and, you know, whatever, email and et cetera, as it becomes more ingrained into our daily life, which is just increasing, you know, as more people are going to get mobile phones and as more people connect their house to the internet, et cetera, it's so deeply ingrained into our daily life that if somebody, I mean, really, it's like right now it's security by obscurity. Like, who cares about hacking my house? Like, no one cares.
Right now it is. This is why I feel like either Bitcoin or probably something like Bitcoin, but not Bitcoin, is going to eventually replace our traditional currency. Because I feel like with all of the security issues and I don't see banks, like the traditional banks, keeping up.
Yeah.
I mean, how many times we've been 3 times in the past 6 or 7 years that we've had credit cards stolen.
You guys personally?
Yeah.
Yeah, it just happened to me again. It's my debit card. You know, somebody tried to withdraw $800 from my ATM machine using a fake debit card.
Right. And like you said, security through obscurity. And I mean, I feel like I'm about as obscure as it gets. And it still happened to me probably 3 times in 5 years.
Well, at least you're not in the dead center of Kentucky.
That's true. At least I'm not in the very center of Kentucky.
Sometimes it feels like it.
Mm.
But yeah, I mean, I agree that Bitcoin is going to, I don't know where that's going to go. It's unclear how that's going to pan out. Yeah, but
Bitcoin itself still kind of feels like a big proof of concept to me.
Me
too. Something else is going to come later.
Me too. But it'll be some kind of cryptocurrency that offers the same concept, which is anonymous digital transactions.
Mm-hmm.
Identity. Like the whole private key encryption is actually genius. But it boils down to, like, to use it for identity, it boils down to either issuing it early and mm-hmm. having all of your, it being your passport / license, /social security number, /passwords for everything, /social security. Yeah. And
like it literally needs to be an implanted chip in your body.
Right. Cause then you get into all of the downsides of all those things. Like, what happens if I lose it? There's no issuing body. Like, you're just up S Creek if you mm-hmm. lose it, because the whole point of it is that only you can know it. So what do you end up doing? You end up writing it down. You end up putting it someplace you shouldn't put it. You end up making it insecure by keeping it someplace outside of your head.
You store your private key in your Dropbox folder.
I've never done that.
I haven't either.
Oh man, it gets really weird. So like you look at something like that issue I had a couple months ago where I got to the airport going to Canada, forgot that I needed my passport, and oh, by the way, it was expired.
Yeah.
And I was able to, there was like a system in place for that situation, you know? So like the government, so in this case, we're talking about the government being that very slow moving thing that is probably, far from perfect, but definitely has built up a certain level of trust through inertia or just mm-hmm. like time, I guess. And then that's kind of it's kind of similar to like a physical encyclopedia where it's just like big and heavy and it took a lot of work to get it there. And like,
right. It's trusted because it's become this big monolithic ever present thing.
Yeah. It has gravitas. Like the form of it has gravitas. And then you like boil that down to Wikipedia or a Google search result for a reverse, or a geo lookup on an IP. And now all of a sudden that's gaining the same credibility as like a government issued ID, basically. I mean, people are
giving it the same weight.
Yeah. There's
whether
just
they should or
no
not,
critical
actually
thought.
Or not, they're doing it.
Yeah. There's no critical thought on, that's insane.
I guess it really shouldn't surprise us though, that people who are going to do things like make death threats and harass someone is not the brightest light bulb in the barrel.
I mean, I agree with that. But at the same time, I think there's like a lot of normal people out there that wouldn't know the difference. You know, they would never be like,
right.
Oh.
It would never occur to them that this data can be wrong.
Yeah, exactly. They just trust it.
Mm-hmm.
It's so tempting. Like, so, okay, probably beating a dead horse here, but there's, I think, a very, very relevant book that's on this topic, at least sort of, it's certainly closely related to trust in online sources. And it's a book called Trust Me, I'm Lying by a guy named Ryan Holiday, mm-hmm. who basically, he's basically a PR guy, and he tries to manufacture viral sharing type of advertising or marketing. Mm-hmm. And he worked for a couple of famous companies. The one that's coming to mind is American Apparel. And he would kind of game the system the, you know, the goal.
Isn't that what marketing is all about?
Well, yes, but he did it in a way that was almost scary. It was scary. Mm. It is scary. So he would say, you know, if he wanted to get an article about American Apparel into, say, the New York Times, he would sort of go all the way down the chain and he'd be like, okay, the guy's the New York Times. The fashion writer is the guy I want to write about us. And I want him to write a particular article, like a favorable article. Mm-hmm. And so to make a long story short, he would research the guy and see what stories he'd been writing about. And then he would Google around and see where the guy found those stories. Cause the guy's not beating the pavement. The reporter of the New York Times is Googling around and like following a bunch of blogs of unknown people or people that are not as known as he is. And he's picking up ideas from there.
Getting his ideas from there. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so then you just get the unknowns to write about you, which is a lot easier to do because they're unknowns.
Yep. He would go down the chain and he wouldn't just go one level down. He'd go like four or five levels down and he would find this one tastemaker who has a just totally unknown blog that other people were basically ripping stuff off of. And they'll link back to him or whatever, but you know, the article would get rewritten a little and watered down and more general. And by the time it hit the New York Times, it was a total telephone game. And he was like, he said, I don't 100% believe this because he seems like a little bit of a shady guy. Sorry, Ryan. But, it started to freak him out because he started to see other people doing it. Like he was like, oh my, he's like, I'm not the first one to think of this. All of a sudden he started recognizing it in other people's work and he would see these stories bubble up. And we've also like if you go in, you know, like you research like a typical, you read like a typical TechCrunch or Verge article. If you're into tech, mm-hmm. they're almost always referencing some other place where they read it first.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's like a less attractive blog that is probably run by one person, or whatever. But somebody's.
I feel like that's the easiest way to write a successful tech blog is find a few less successful ones and rewrite their articles with a little bit better grammar.
Yeah, and link back to them in a nicer design, in a bigger audience. And it just these things bubble up. And it happened to me. Like, it happened to me with the Starbucks card thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it did.
I blogged about it. Then Brian Jepson, my editor from the O'Reilly books, blogged about it on a more popular blog than mine. And then that got picked up by a bigger blog and it got picked up by a bigger blog.
And then you were being interviewed by CNN.
Yeah. Within
like a day,
a weekend. I was on the phone with a producer at Good Morning America.
Yeah. That all escalated really quickly.
Yeah. It got out of control fast. But that's it. So to me, when I read this book, I was like, this guy's 100% right. Like he might be full of it and this might be just a promotional thing for him to get hired to do it for people. I'm sure he got tons of work out of it. Mm-hmm. But I guarantee you that it works. And so it raises the question, you know, to bring it back to the topic. It's like, who do you trust? And like, do you trust them? And everybody knows it's like, it's sort of a cliche to like, you know, oh, someone said it online, so it must be true. But the fact is, you believe it's true. Like your default position is if you read something, you believe it's true. Like if it's not April 1st, I assume it's true.
Yeah. No matter how weird. If it's not April 1st or if it doesn't come from the onion you assume it's true.
Yeah. It's like April 1st. Wait a second. Is this an Onion article? And then who's the other guy? There's a guy that writes for the New Yorker that does these pieces. He fools me every time because it looks real. I can't even think of his name. But those are the three things. Other than that, I assume it's probably true.
Yeah.
And if anybody should know better, it should be us. Anyway, folks, check your sources.
Yeah, I guess that's the big takeaway. Check your sources.
Before you throw a broken toilet on somebody with a death threat in it on somebody's driveway. Somebody's
driveway in Kansas.
Oh, man.
Can you imagine years and years of this?
No, I would move. I mean, come on.
Yeah, I would too. I'd put up with it for like, I'd move.
It probably started slowly and they're like, what's going on?
Yeah.
They probably didn't. I wonder how long it took them to figure out what it was. You know?
They didn't know until this article was written why this was happening.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah. The author of the article is the person that uncovered what was happening and called them about it and talked to them about it.
Okay. Anyway, we'll link to it in the show notes.
Link to the article.
Yeah. Now I want to read it. None of it's true, but it's a good story. And we are robots.
Yeah.
So terrifying robots. All right, folks, that's our show for this week. I'm Jonathan Stark.
And I'm Kelly Shaver.
And we hope you join us again next week for Terrifying Robot Dog. Bye.
Bye.
Would you like to support Terrifying Robot Dog? Just think of two friends who dig the show and send them to terrifyingrobotdog.com for links to iTunes, Facebook, and RSS feeds. If you don't have two friends, you can still help us out by leaving a nice review in iTunes. Thanks.
It's like they went out one day and there was a broken toilet on the driveway and they're like, we don't know what that's about.
Okay. There's that.
That happened.
And they didn't flush?